answer that he essentially comes to is it's a social activity that people pursue in order to fit in, and that it all comes about as a product of language, that words begin essentially as tools for interacting with one another. We come up with the word for a snake because it's useful for us to be able to identify a snake as a dangerous thing that should be avoided. And similarly, we develop words for elk as it's a food source. You know, there's an elk over there to pursue. And that as our societies become increasingly complex, the words and the concepts that we develop become complex as well. And what we call truth is essentially what we have all decided that we can agree is this is a particular way of viewing the world that is useful for us. And so this is how truth is propagated. So I'm not as nimble on my feet as I have to put in my mouth. So for example, when we see an elk and we name it a mammal, we're not saying anything true about the elk itself. The elk is just that elk. But the concept of mammal as a genera of a way of categorizing things is something that is useful for us as humans. And because of this usefulness, we allow ourselves to essentially be ruled by these particular way of viewing the world. And this is, to Nietzsche, what essentially our scientific, rational view of the world is. It's a useful way of viewing the world, and he doesn't want to denigrate it in any way. It certainly has value. In fact, the fact that he is writing this essay explaining what truth is and how it functions in our society indicates that he does think that there is value in the communicative aspect of language. But he also thinks that there's other ways of viewing the world as well. And by presenting this way of viewing truth, what he does is he opens up other possibilities and other ways of viewing the world. And one way of viewing the world that Nietzsche was particularly interested in was the aesthetic view of the world, which is, he takes to mean we have these, our immediate way of perceiving the world is, as we mentioned in our last talk, through emotions and instinct. And we sort of derive concepts from these emotions and tend to put them in rational constructs in order to get along well in the world. But what the artist does and what the aesthetic way of life is you take these instinctual metaphors, ways of viewing the world, and you kind of piece them together or mash them up in order to sort of disrupt your normal way of viewing the world. And so the experience that you can get, the ideal experience of viewing a great piece of art is reframing your perception, the way that you perceive the world that you're not used to viewing in your typical rational way of going about life. And he thought that there were some pretty wild consequences of this way of viewing the world. There's a quote here where he describes the ancient Greek society, which he says this was the time in ancient Greece when the aesthetic view of life was more dominant than the rational view. And he says, because of the way that myth takes it for granted that miracles are always happening, the waking life of a mythically inspired people, the ancient Greeks, for instance, more closely resembles a dream than does the waking world of a scientifically disenchanted thinker. When every tree can suddenly speak as a nymph, when a god in the shape of a bull can drag away maidens, when even the goddess Athena herself is suddenly seen in the company of Pisistratus, driving through the marketplace of Athens with a beautiful team of horses, and this is what the honest Athenian believed, then, as in a dream, anything is possible at each moment, and all of nature swarms around man as if it were nothing but a masquerade of the gods who were merely amusing themselves by deceiving men in all these shapes. And I was really inspired by this. I went camping last weekend in a place called Devil's Glen, and I started wondering how it could have gotten that name. And I was just wondering if somebody had a story of encountering the devil in this glen. It occurred to me, like, what a cool way to live. What a cool world it would be if you could genuinely go out into nature and have believe that you can encounter these phenomenon that normally aren't accepted in our normal way of viewing life. And then I'm going to end with one more quote here. This is, he contrasts the rational man from the intuitive man, the person who is guided by these intuitive ways of viewing the world. The man who is guided by concepts and abstractions only succeeds by such means in warding off misfortune, without ever gaining any happiness for himself from these abstractions. And while he aims for the greatest possible freedom from pain, the intuitive man, standing in the midst of culture, already reaps from his intuition a harvest of continually inflowing illumination, cheer, and redemption, in addition to obtaining a defense against misfortune. To be sure, he suffers more intensely when he suffers. He even suffers more frequently, since he does not understand how to learn from experience and keeps falling over and over again into the same ditch. He is then just as irrational in sorrow as he is in happiness. He cries aloud and will not be consoled. That's all I got. Henry's got to figure out what that has to do with anything.
You can throw out these questions.
I think there's a ton of relevance. I mean, the first thing I want to bring up is, so Abram also has a very a distinction. I mean, he distinguishes between animistic cultures and alphabetic cultures, because he sees the lack of our culture's animism and perception of the rest of the living, more than human world as speaking and as animate and as alive, as rooted in written language, in the written alphabet. Because if you think about it, when you're reading a book, it's like a highly concentrated form of animism. You're hallucinating someone speaking to you. You're hallucinating these images. The words are speaking out to you. I mean, there's tons of accounts of illiterate cultures when people would go into them or bringing the Bible, and the people would immediately be like, you know, this book, and they immediately put their ear up to the book to try to like hear. And there's that, but that's not like wrong. I mean, that's what it is. Like when it's kind of like a magic. It's kind of like a very highly concentrated form of animistic perception that saps the rest of the speaking world of its power. It concentrates it in this, in the text. And so what the effect of that is for Abrams, it's like, you know, you read a book, you read like the word table or the word tree, and now you have this tree. Now you have, and what's significant about this too is Plato was writing at around the time that Athens got written language. Abram speculates that his idea of forms, of the idea that you could even take table or tree out of examples and put it in this conceptual world, that comes from the fact that there could now be a word for table. That when you're thinking of the abstract concept of a table, you're really thinking of the word table and the way it affects you in the text as a sort of, as a thing itself. And so this is significant because then we take that idea and we project it back out into the world. So what we project back out into the world is a set of categories and judgments on that world that generalize, like we talked about a couple of stops ago with like how, you know, the bleed over of, we talked about how mass-produced objects could have this bleed over effect where you see trees as just instances of non-specific objects. Well, there's this other way that compounds with that as a factor that you could see in the same thing happens, where now you have this concept for tree that you just project out and you impose onto the world without paying attention to it, without engaging with it as individuals or discovering what differences and intricacies those beings might have, which, as we talked about in the last stop, would sort of imply or lead to a more animistic perception of that thing when it's engaging with your senses in a way that brings it to life. And that's the sort of way that like learning, unlearning animism is really like the teaching of those concepts, of those like alphabetic literal sort of projections onto the world. And so now we're at a point in the talk where we talked about how these things affect our perception and what the difference is between being connected to an animistic, living, breathing world of specific objects that we can have intimate personal connections with versus like a technological world of things, of non-specific things that we don't have any connection with and where we are isolated. And we've also talked about why it might matter for the world in that it's like, you know, in that having this animistic perception might lead to more moral behavior, having a sort of deeper connection to things will help us care about them. So now we're at a point where we can talk about, well, how do we do that? What's a process for enlivening our sense of personal connection to the things around us. And this is why I'm really interested in wonder, because I see those literal projections as a kind of judgment. Like we're judging, you know, if I see a tree and I think, oh, it's just a tree, I'm judging it in the sense, like in a judgment, I see it as a final decision that you're making about all that something is and could be. By judging something, you're claiming you can contain it completely, that you have it entirely within yourself, that it can't surprise you, that it doesn't have agency, that it can't do something or influence you in any way, because you've decided it's a tree, you've dismissed it, you've moved it aside, and that also means you're no longer paying attention to it. And so I think the remedy for judgment is attention, is looking and paying attention to the specific intricacies of things, of engaging yourself and your body with that thing, and that this kind of attention, which loosens the judgment of things, can produce wonder. Because wonder is sort of to see something as something that could surprise you, to see it as something. Wonder happens when you're disoriented, when you don't have a clear grasp of what's happening, when things amaze you or surprise you. And I think that we can suspend our judgment as a way to cultivate a sense of wonder, which means if wonder is the suspension of judgment, or if wonder can come about through the suspension of judgment, and if judgment is deciding everything that something could be, then suspending that means allowing it to be many other things, which could be recognizing all of the ways that it as an individual engages with you that defy that concept. But it can go further than that too, into the world of myth and metaphor, like how Nietzsche talks about believing that Athena could be walking through the marketplace. The way that sort of, like, you have to allow something to allow for that wonder and awe and mystery, you're allowing it to unfold into its own metaphors, to work with you and work with your engagement with it in a way that it could be anything. And this could be, this relates too to the stick. It could be like any number of different sorts of things could be used and played with in any different number of ways. Wonder is what allows, like wonder sort of allows for the plasticity of the things around us. And this in turn makes it harder for us to judge them and decide that they're resources, decide that they're only one sort of thing. Because once you've judged something, you can only, there's only, you know, you're no longer attending to it, you're no longer allowing it to express itself in any way, you're no longer allowing yourself to be surprised by it. So there's only one thing you can do. You can either use it or ignore it. That's it. It becomes a binary. So the only way we can stop viewing things as resources is by suspending that judgment and allowing ourselves to have wonder, allowing ourselves to not decide that we already know everything about the world and what it is, and decide that we can learn things from the spontaneous interactions and actions of those things themselves, to be surprised and to try to live in an enchanted world where anything is possible might actually be not only like not a escapist sort of fantasy, but actually an ethical way of living in the world that's rewarding for both us and the world. That's what it seems like to me. That was a little bit of I got on a soapbox there.
The thing that really strikes me about what you're just saying is that it has this whole other application, that same way of thinking of how we are with humans judging other humans.
Yes.
I mean, we don't allow a sense of wonder, but that's what racism is all about. Mm-hmm. I mean, we put a race in a category, and we don't allow them to surprise us with wonder because we've already made up our minds that they're there. So it's like, it sounds like maybe a human tendency, or maybe it's a modern human tendency, or whatever, how that comes about. But yeah, we should be opening our minds in ways even beyond the nature.
Absolutely. I mean, I think about, I used example in my thesis of like, imagine how if you've judged, like if you're arguing with someone, and everyone's had this experience, I think, like, of, you know, if you've judged that someone's angry at you, and they're like, and you've just decided that someone's mad at you, think about how much harder it is for them to convince you they're not.
Yeah.
Right?
Or just that they don't like you.
Yeah, exactly. If you've decided that.
Somebody doesn't like you for whatever, they really can't, you can't get out of that box.
Right.
What you were saying, I was thinking about teachers in the schools where I do speech, and how some teachers, they don't have that sense of wonder, or don't get a kick out of what comes out of kids. They just want to like put the information in them and have them behave a certain way, And it's the teachers who have this sense of wonder about the kids or find the humor in so much that I think are more successful with them.
And those teachers, too, that don't have that sense of wonder and just judge things as a set of right and wrong answers.
Yes.
They're doing nothing but providing a set of judgments for kids, too.
So
they're just teaching a set of judgments
thing
about the world, rather than teaching a way of having wonder and an investigative, curious attitude towards the world.
I think
it's
something else, you just reminded me of something like... Oh, sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you. I was going to say, you reminded me of something that ties into what you're saying earlier. I was in the Museum of the Rockies a couple weeks ago, and there was this kid, there was like some kids in there, and there was this one kid, and it was like, I found it so fascinating, probably because he wasn't my kid and I didn't have to deal with him.
That's the best.
Yeah, so, but he was like, he was walking around the museum, and he was looking at the dinosaur, he's like, Dad, there's ghosts in here. There's ghosts, and his dad's like, yeah, that's great, kid. But I think like, it's kind of like, I think kids, sometimes too, because they're more like they're less away from the conceptual judging mode that we use all the time, we get habituated to it. They actually have access to some aspects of things that we don't really have, but like we can learn. Because I think another thing with another way that when I thought about your attention thing, it's like presence as well, too, right? Like it being when you make a judgment, you don't have to be present anymore. Like, I've decided that person's angry at me.
You can't be present.
You can't be present.
So long as you have that judgment, it's
exactly
impossible to be both present to something and have
you close that out.
Yeah,
so I mean, like, it's also kind of like a practice thing, too, you know, of, like, finding different ways. Because it is hard. I mean, we are a very conceptual-driven, judgment-based. It's like how we go along most of the time, you know. But I think it's, I like the way you said that. I think that's a really good point on it, for sure.
Yeah. So, one of the things that other cultures have used, they have used ways to restore that sense of wonder through, like, intense chanting or drumming or even chemical substances that would make you look at the world in a really different way. And when you read accounts of that, what they see the goddess coming down the street. I mean, they see the tree coming alive. And so I wonder how elimination of those kinds of practices in our culture have helped to destroy and eliminate that sense of wonder, because like the son in the Museum of the Rockies saying, well, yeah, there's no ghosts here. And really what we're looking at is ghosts. We're looking at ghosts reincarnated.
Yeah,
right.
There are ghosts all over that place.
Right, right.
There really were.
And so for an adult to like shush or, you know, kind of dismiss it is the way we look at it. If I said, oh, I saw the spirit of that tree, somebody would say, well, Marie, you need to go see your psychiatrist, you know. So, it's not accepted in our culture, and we don't promote the use of different kinds of practices that would restore that to us as adults.
I absolutely agree with you.
I guess I have a problem.
I said that a lot, haven't I?
You always say that.
I'm going to challenge you on that.
That's one of the things I love about you.
I guess I want to make a distinction between kind of allowing us to live in metaphorical terms as opposed to living in literal terms, because the world of Nietzsche as he describes it, where Athena can walk down the street, is also a world of witch trials where we can burn somebody for being a witch, okay? And his call to aesthetics is also one that is subjective rather than objective. I mean, an elk could walk up there and one person could say, oh, that is a magnificent animal, and somebody could say, that animal is really one of the ugliest animals I've ever seen. You know, I really think it should be shaped more like a mountain lion or whatever. You know, aesthetics is subjective rather than objective. But I think those things work if we can accept them in a metaphorical realm, because it's like, okay, I'm a writer and I will do things like have talking cats on stage and stuff like that. And so I don't have any problem with non-realism in that sense, but kind of allowing this distinction between what is objective and what is metaphorical.
I think
So I'm going to push back on that a little bit. I mean, no, I think that that the objective is unreachable in a sense, because we only have our own experiences of the world, and that objective realm of what is true or not comes about through this development of concepts that we're then projecting back onto our lived experience. But that's not to say, so the witch trials example is interesting, because I think that that's an extreme example of a judgment. I mean, it's a trial, so, yes. But it, like, those people were judged unequivocally to be witches, and not allowed, like, no one was paying attention, or allowing any other possibilities in, mm-hmm. the, in an experience of those women, and I think it comes about through a very, I mean, that came about at a very particular time in history when a lot of, like, Puritan sort of attitudes of, like, a very black and white, very judgmental perception of what mm-hmm. the world is, was made of, and could be, that's different from our scientific way of judging what is true, but is still a judgment. But I would also say that I think there's a risk always in these sorts of things of taking them too seriously, but I wouldn't, like, taking, you know, whatever metaphors or experiences you have or spiritual experiences, of taking them too seriously, but I wouldn't say that I definitely wouldn't want to keep them in a metaphorical realm apart from what's true, because I think it's very much true. They're very much real. It's just that once you try to take anything, whether it's a fact about the world that you could argue is more conventionally objectively true, like something like, you know, that this is made of wood, or some perception of some god or whatever that came out of the tree, I think that taking that to such an extreme that you no longer are paying attention, that you're no longer changing or being aware of changes in the world around you, or how it might reflect, like, less, you know, this is where the pragmatism comes in, like, what works. Once it stops being something that's useful, that's effective and stops being something that reflects the world, I think that it becomes sort of a dogma, a judgment that, But I wouldn't want to say in any sense that metaphor is in facts or in sort of two different categories of truth. Just that either one can be taken too seriously.
I think you still have witch trials too. I mean, like, incarcerating people for having crack cocaine.
Well, I'm referring to supernatural.
It's delusional thinking, though, right? I mean, like, right. It's delusional to think there's a witch. It's also delusional, like, when we do these mass things with people based on race. Right. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's how I see it, is, like, it's delusional at a certain level.
Well, certainly in, you know, in the knots, when we rounded up people and interrogated them, you know, violently, very much like a witch trial, where you're, you know, you're obviously that the only real goal, the honest, true goal, is to get them to say the lie that you want them to say. Mm-hmm. Yes, I am a witch. Mm-hmm. You know, yes, Saddam Hussein and you know, and Osama bin Laden are real good buddies. You know, I'll say that because you're hurting me.
Yeah, they've already been judged.
Yeah, and you're being judged, and so those things are, you know, they're ongoing. They're not gone. You know, we have different versions of that stuff, but, you know, in some ways we evolve, and in some ways we don't change at all.
There is also something I would like to add to the comment about the distinction between, you know, metaphor and dogma and all that. There's a philosopher you might be interested in, I guess you consider him a philosopher, anthropologist, who, named Robert Bringhurst, who writes about a theory of mythology. He has a very short essay, which is great, on what is myth. And he considers myth to be a parallel kind of science, and science as a parallel kind of mythology. Because when you look at cultures and how they develop their myths and their sciences, science is a look at how things are outside of our relationship to them. So, and that evolves as the more you learn about those things. So that, look, you know, you're looking at, but it assumes that everything is dead. It assumes that everything is as unlike us as possible, and you are just learning about how those things work as if all participants in it are dead. Whereas mythology looks at the same world, but looks at it through the lens of our relationship to it. And it has to evolve just in the same way science has to evolve. It has to learn. The more attention we look at the world, the more we change our relationship to it, our mythology and our metaphors have to change too. through that attention, through that openness to the new information the world might give us. And when he has this line, like, a myth that has like become dogmatic is a religion, or whatever, you know, that like a mythology that has stopped learning becomes just a set of rules that is just as much a judgment about reality as just some outdated science or pseudoscience is, as is a bad judgment, a bad read of reality. So I think that in situations where mythology doesn't reflect, where the metaphors of the world don't reflect a helpful way of seeing it, yeah, we need to be willing to change them, but I wouldn't think that holding the whole category of mythology as less than reality, as in fear of that, is the right move.
Well, I didn't make. I specifically didn't say the word truth, and I didn't specifically say the word reality. I said objectively for that reason.
Okay.
Because I think mythology is true in certain ways, but you know, pretty much objectively, you know, I can't set that piece of wood on fire with my mind, right?
So, no matter how many people
you
explain
it, you hear
that. Isn't that kind of crossing? That's kind of crossing the wires, right? Like that's like putting myth and science in like they're parallel for a reason.
Thank you so much.
But it doesn't mean you can't light the on fire with your mind. It would just be it would happening in a realm. Maybe that's what you're saying, though. That it's like
maybe there's a way to do it, and we just don't know how yet. I mean that's possible, right? I mean, like if you took our technologies and showed someone 3,000 years ago, it'd freak them out. They'd say, that can't be, that can't exist. So, I mean, like, and also within science, too, I mean, like, there's all kinds of mythologies within science because what they thought in the 19th century was absolutely true, now everyone's like, well, that's not absolutely true. And now they have more things, right, with, like, they don't understand, like, black holes and all this stuff that, or the Big Bang that, they say a Big Bang happened, but it really doesn't match in with, they don't know how to explain it or what it means.
Right.
That could be a form of mythology that in like 3,000 years, they look back and they say, oh, you guys are so stupid. You thought a black, right. You didn't know what a black hole was. You thought it was this thing and it's actually right. This thing.
Well, I want to be careful with using myth, because that's using myth in a totally different way as like false truth, which is like, I think a little.
No, I think it's true relative. Yeah. I mean, it's like it forms your horizon of what you can know, because like even though they had theory, like even though they had certain theories about science that weren't true, they still did things within that realm, but then they thought it was absolutely true, and then later someone said that's not absolutely true.
So look at planetary motion, just to step aside. Okay, what we can observe is objectively true is that the planets are moving. Okay, now science comes in and says, oh, it's gravity. Somebody else could say there are fairies pushing the planets around. Okay, we can't distinguish those two scientific theories, but we can agree objectively that the planets are moving. So there's room there for objectism separate from truth, okay?
You're one thing I have. Another problem is, not to quote you, but another problem with these two ways of looking at things that, you know, that there's necessarily a great difference between, you know, naming something and know it by its category and dismissing it. What if you, you know, name something like a pond rose upon there and keep going deeper and deeper and deeper and categorizing, pretty soon you get back to where it's an individual again. You know, it's a ponderosa pine, but it's a West Slope ponderosa pine. It's a certain subspecies that's been here for 12,000 years in this area, and that's an individual that's maybe 300 years old. And so the more you learn about that thing, the more attributes of it that you can name and categorize, the higher stack of categories, the more the thing becomes and specific individual again, you know, and I kind of think, you know, to me, I'm raised in a scientific culture, that's how I commune with nature, by learning what I can about it. And the more I learn, the more individual these things become. And I guess I could imagine, if I know enough about that tree, eventually I might be able to imagine the phoenix climbing it or something. You know, To me, naming something is not necessarily dismissing it. You know, once I have it named, you know, I don't control it. I say, oh, that's kind of cool. What else can I learn about this thing? What else can I name about it? And you can go and go and go and go, and pretty soon you're communing with it. You know, that tree has a personality. Mm-hmm. And when I think of venting with nature, that's kind of the way I think I do it. I go out hiking and stuff speaks to me that way, and pretty soon there's an emotional attachment mm-hmm. that comes from knowing that very non-mythical personality mm-hmm. the thing has. And I don't know how to put my finger on that, but I have a hard time separating, you know, the world of science and the world of myth. To me, they're sort of, like someone said, they might be the same thing at base. At least there's a happy medium. You can
some overlap.
I'm 1 foot and it's the half.
Yeah, I
go ahead. I'm done.
Oh, you're good.
I tend to ramble.
You're good. I think that, I mean, first of all, the Buber quote about, like, they're certainly not contradictory. Like, Buber said, there's nothing I must forget in order to see something of the subject. There's nothing I must unlearn about it. So you don't need to, like, forget what species a tree is, or not even have that, or not have that a part of your experience in order to connect with it deeply. I also think that, like, maybe that's, like, maybe what's happening when you're seeing it, like, so specifically when you're naming it and going deeper and deeper into it, making it more and more specific, is, you know, technically what's happening is you're shrinking the category, but it's still keeping it as a category. And then what matters is, like, it gets harder and harder the more limited the category it is. It gets harder to see the category and not the individual.
Yeah.
So it's a matter of, like, where your focus is. Like, you could technically, like, a computer could, like, list every factor of that tree uh-huh. and to extreme specificity. And that computer, you would not imagine would be having a connection to that tree. But, like, you could have, like, that... a list, you know, of all the characteristics of that tree and still just be seeing the category. But you could also have that list of characteristics and have that as a tool, as a vehicle, to see into the category.
Yeah, exactly.
To see into, like, the individual, because it makes it more of a window.
Tree,
so it totally, yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It totally is, like, a way to deeply connect to things, I think. So long as you're not, like, just thinking of the labels, but are looking at the thing itself, you know?
Yeah.
I'm going to raise the walking stick here. I could do this all day long. I love this. No, I just realized the time. But this is also a sign of great conversation. I really appreciate it. We're close to the walking trail, but while we're all standing here, I'd like to just thank Henry and Ryan for leading us through this discussion today. You guys were great. And thank you to every one of you as well. You brought up some wonderful things to think about, added so much to the conversation. We will have philosophy walks through November of this year. In fact, the next one David will be leading in September. We also have several other things in queue, workshops, a mini symposium at Carroll, and some other things. So we hope that check our website and see if there's anything that sparks your interest. We'd love to have you back. This is an awesome group. I really appreciate it, and thanks for taking your time for this morning and spending it with us.
Yeah, thanks for putting it all together.